There are young guys on my staff, one of them at least. He was always talking about when things would get going tough. Where's my nitro pills? Well, I know you blow things up with nitro. I had my suspicions about him in many areas with his dependence on his nitro. Last Friday, a week ago Friday, around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, I was getting one of my periodic haircuts where the lady comes out, cuts my hair. Some of you remember one day we showed you on TV. I was getting a haircut by her at Silver Oaks. In the middle of a haircut with the wrappings on, gray hair everywhere, I jumped on the cart being pulled by King of High Point and did a circle looking like Batman with the cape flowing and hair flying. But this was sort of a nippy day, and I decided to take the haircut on the front porch. And I was sitting out there, and the more that she worked on my hair, the more I was praying it would be over. As I began to feel dull pain that increased in my chest. And when she finally finished, I went in the house and still was feeling the pain, wondered, maybe I don't know what that is either. I'm sick so seldom, but I hear people talk about pleurisy, whatever that is. Maybe I got pleurisy. That's nice. New condition. The pain continued clear into the afternoon, and eventually I got wise enough to call for an EKG at my house. When the EKG was done, there was a little disturbance in the front of the heart area as they read the machine. We then took it in for a second opinion and then called the leading cardiologist in the area, faxed to him a copy, and he ordered me instantly to the hospital. He recommended they send an ambulance, and I said, no frickin' way. I can get there before the ambulance can get here. And we went, and everything was waiting when we got there, the manager of the hospital. Thank God I didn't have to mess with the usual problems at some hospitals where they're more interested in paperwork than they are your life. The cardiologist and the head of the hospital were waiting in the emergency entrance as we drove in, and the doctor wheeled me straight on in. And angiogram immediately, angioplasty to follow, and then a second surgery that I didn't even know about, that I only found out about after I was home a couple of days ago, when I was asked, did you know you had two surgeries? And I said, no, I didn't. They had brought me into the recovery room, and apparently I woke up with severe pain again, and they rushed me back and did what, to you who know the technology, they put a stent in. The problem was one of the main arteries to the heart was, when I came into the hospital, closed up. They opened it with the angioplasty. And after that surgery, apparently it collapsed again. And so they put some sewer grating in me. Some very light stainless steel, so light it floats on water, which they put inside the artery, and it holds the artery in place, which creates a critical healing period. But that was the second surgery, was to put the stent in and, in essence, hold the artery open with that piece of metal I got in here now. I can't go on commercial airlines anymore. It's been a long time since I've gone on a commercial airline, but I won't pass that little buzzer. They say, "What's that?" I said, "My heart." I didn't know about the stent operation. I was so far out of it at that time. So, two of them. But the reason for this is not only to report to you that I know I have a concern and have shown your affection and I've not been unable to hide my joy at your response, but also to make a point. Just before I went into the surgery, laying on the table with the doctor directing all the preparatory things that were happening, he says, "Here, take this and put a nitro pill underneath my tongue." And the pain, amazingly, began to subside before I even reached the point where the surgery began. And all of a sudden, I have a new view of nitro pills. Now, I mean, you got to watch me. I might take a nitro pill for a toothache. Or some other kind of ache. I mean, I suddenly understood why 68 years of my life I have not needed nitro, but when I needed it, man, was it precious. Now, I don't think I need it today. Hope I never need it again. But it's close by. It's there if I need it. And to these four-year-old staff members of mine, I can say, "Run out, I got one." Now you may wonder where I'm going with that. I have a new name for the seven messages I preach every year. Nitro pills. Amazing. There's a big difference between understanding a nitro pill to the point you can give a chemical analysis of it on instant recital and applying it when needed. I think I've demonstrated in 22 years that I don't have enough time, if I pastor here another 20 years, to finish some of the subjects that are new. But I have, except for last year, revisited seven messages because I have known throughout my life that even though I know these messages probably better than you, there comes a time when they, like the nitro pill, come into use. And I want to remind you every single year, so you've got them in your spiritual pocket, that when the time comes, stick them in your mouth and proclaim your faith as you make it an application to your life, not just a message that you remember. So expect me for the next 20 years to not miss another year in which I return to at least these 7, hopefully 12. And sure enough, this time one of the messages that I preach came out of my spiritual pocket. It's the only one other time in my life has mortality come very close to me. I've been blessed with good health. You've seen me every size and shape, but I'm able to hold my own in getting on with life without crippling around more than most people. I remember sitting in a chair in front of my house we called Doc's Pad after the reality of my dad's death set in. There was something about him always being out there that I never thought about my life coming to a terminal point. How could it? I mean, there's dad, healthy as a 20-year-old, going strong, and he's so many years older than me. At least I got that many years. And as I sat on that chair in front of the house and let some private grief settle in, I remember thinking, well, maybe I only got this many years left to do what is so unfinished. That's the only time I ever thought about that. Because Dad was always out there in front of me. Well, I hit it, and I joked even on the operating table, because they do this surgery with a local anesthetic in a rather sensitive place that makes you want to shoot nurses for 3 days or probing in that area. And they just come in 2 and 3 at a time. I figured, why can't just, you know, one hand do this? Don't let your imagination go wild now. You know, another thing that's kind of funny, the doctor would come in, he'd get pecked a couple of times. It's like the nurses had bad eyesight. They had to feel around like a blind man trying to find a frog or something. I didn't know that arteries do not have any nerves on the inside. So the anesthetic is in the area where they enter this arterial route. And led pretty good, didn't I? So there's a local anesthetic, and then they insert the probe. And I'm laying there watching all this on the television screen because I'm not out, and they've killed the pain where I would feel the pain, and once the various instruments that they put inside and go up to probe and open the artery and to, in the unknown surgery, put the grating in, you don't feel anything. Now I'm, you know, joking with the doctor, asking if he knew what Moses said to God on Mount Sinai. And he's manipulating and watching the TV, and he says, no, what? Well, now let me get this straight, God. They get all the oil, and we got to cut the end off of our what? And he said, ha ha. I had a much better sense of humor than the doctors did. Well, I was covering up. Because when I got there, I still couldn't believe it was that serious. And as the operation proceeded, and I'm looking on the screen, and I'm seeing my heart and those spidery artery extensions or vessels and blood flowing fused here in that black and white TV screen, and the heart's sort of, look at that. I realized there was a chance I wouldn't make it. Or might not make it out as whole in strength and life as I was. And I went through my spiritual pill bottle and out leaped Deuteronomy 33. So I preach it again today as one of the seven for the year, because I learned firsthand when you need it, you need to be reminded. And the reason it leaped out is Moses is at the end of his ministry. He's been denied the chance to deliver the people first, and then 40 years in the wilderness, and called by God in the burning bush. He resists going, then goes, and he finally agrees to go. And the first stop at the end of the way, on the way to Egypt, God sends an angel to kill him as he exacts another, turn me down just a little, as he exacts another degree of commitment out of Moses. He leads these people forth, and they become a complaining, burdensome mess. On one point, God wants to kill them and tells Moses, step aside. I want to kill them all and start over with you. I've wondered lots of times as I've studied Moses as one of the most compelling personalities of the Old Testament. Have you ever had any regrets about that? As he's still laboring with these people that God wanted to kill and told Moses, you get out of the way. Let me kill them. Wipe them all out. And I'll start over with you. Now he's going to miss the promised land because of these same people. He's been taken up to Mount Nebo. And God says, I'll let you look at the land, but you're not going in. He begged, and God said, don't even talk to me about it anymore. You're not going. Because in an anger fit, and the anger was not the problem, he had an anger fit at Mount Sinai, and God didn't consider that sin. But in this anger fit, he interfered with God's plan of revelation and struck the rock that was the type of Christ a second time, when Christ is only going to die once. And because he did that, when God had said, speak to the rock, don't strike it, and interfered with God's revelatory drama, God punishes him and denies him the promised land. Now God says, I want you to deliver a final message to these people that are going to go in, and Joshua's going to lead them, and I'll go before them. You're not going. Now the good news footnote is, three times recorded in the New Testament, Matthew 17, Mark 9, Luke 9, Jesus is on the Mount of Transfiguration. His disciples fail him again and fall asleep, and they should be watching with him. And God sends Elijah and Moses to comfort him. Thus, Moses, over whose body Jude says Satan and Michael fought because God had a purpose for it. And Michael won, and they carried Moses to a secret burying ground in Moab. God knew where it was, because here comes Moses into the promised land on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus. So you're in good hands with God. And that's what made this message come alive to me, because I have enough faith. I'm ready to go. I have enough faith that I believe the truth. It's more blessed to depart than to be here. I teach and believe that death is a beginning, not an end. So those fears do not disturb me. There's so much yet to do. I feel my ministry, which is his ministry, has just begun. Stumbled and been held back by problems that I've dealt with for the last 2.5 years. Just solving those problems, to be struck down as I was laying on that bed. Doesn't seem God knows what he's doing. I don't have any heart trouble in my family. You watch my dad. My mother was in the same intensive care unit. She was there with pneumonia. She'll be coming out in a couple of days. We were in the same floor. Nobody let her know I had a heart attack. We just lied to her a little. Told her I just was there to be close to her. You fundamentalists kill people while you serve your own spiritual image. You think I wanted my mother to know I was in the intensive care unit with her having a heart attack? Just want to get close to you. Make sure these people are taking care of you properly. But God doesn't seem to know what he's doing sometimes. And it didn't seem the right way to go. Just when I was getting things under control, to be stricken down. And that's why I put this in context with Moses' life. Moses' life ends in disappointment until you go to the Mount of Transfiguration. That's a much better entrance. Then going across Jordan and having to do that dirty job that Joshua did at Gilgal. Remember that? They crossed Jordan finally in the promised land. And then all of those born in the wilderness that had not been circumcised got it at Gilgal. And they're crippled. Well, man, if you really had to choose between entering the promised land and your first job is that surgical maneuver on over 3 million people, men and boys, wouldn't you rather stand in the glory on the Mount of Transfiguration? You just have to wake up the disciples. So, in the context is where this Song of Asher comes. Thy shoes shall be iron and brass, Deuteronomy 33. I want to go through that fast. You don't use iron and brass shoes to walk in the bedroom, go to the house, go all around the house and walk on a carpet. Thy shoes shall be iron and brass. Means, and you know this message has this name, tough shoes, because it's a tough trip. If God intended Christianity to be a hammock, you wouldn't even need house shoes. Now, you've heard this message 21 times. It's on the internet. You can pull it down daily and listen to it. It'll be on the internet again when this Sunday goes on the internet in the next 2 weeks. I want you to look at it in the context of the nitrile pill. That somewhere your steps, your path, gonna make this message very meaningful. That God provides tough shoes because it's a tough trip. We're going to a place where the spending money is faith tried in the fire. Don't envy the baby or the thief on the cross who make it in because of God's grace but have no spending money. Oh, I view them the same way I view the heathen. They're in God's hands, a God of grace, a God of wisdom, a God who will deal with them in eternities of more than time. But the spending money of eternity, which is not some layer of clouds we float in some existential nothingness of ecstasy, a very real world with real activity in which the fortunes and spending money and the only legal tender, faith, tried in the fire. God has got us in a developmental stage where He orders toughness into the trip in order to demonstrate that we can survive because the shoes are tough enough for the trip. And shoes are for walking. You don't stand still. You can stand still without shoes. Thousands of times I've said Christianity is a journey. I'd like to exempt myself and come to a point where I know it all. You come here once a week and I'll tell you what's going to happen to you. It ain't going to happen to me because I've been through it all. The Bible shows the older the saint, the more mature the saint, the tougher the test. The cross came at the end of Jesus' ministry. Everything got him ready for it. Not at the beginning. This is supposed to be a tough trip. I don't know what toughness is hitting you I just know the last thing in the world I expected to happen to me was a heart attack. I was in better shape than I'd been since I was in college. I was doing everything right except the stress of dealing with problems I made very public of reorganizing my staff. But I didn't expect a heart attack. Doesn't run in our family. God surprised me. And He tested my faith. The shoes are tough because the trip's tough and something's going to hit us all. But the shoes are tough enough to make the trip. Same message as blessed men go through their valleys. Okay? On that tough trip, you could preach this message. All I want to do is a little more personally apply it. On that tough trip, the shoes of which are tough enough to make it, as thy days, so shall thy strength be. The New Testament speaks, and I've probably 10,000 times pointed this out, not clear in the King James, it is in the Greek. Ye shall not be tempted beyond that which ye are able, implied to bear. Because with every temptation, God provides therewith, accompanying the temptation, a way of escape. The Greek makes it very clear that whatever temptation is hitting the myriad numbers of people in this congregation, including me on that operating table a week ago, and whoever is listening around the world, the specificity of your temptation that makes us all sometimes cry out inwardly, nobody can understand what I'm facing. Nothing comes on the saint of God without God's knowledge and God's allowance, and sometimes His push. But with every myriad, in our mind, innumerable temptations that falls at the same time, God has provided with equal specifics the way out. A door with a key already in it. It's not as though we have to get God's attention and say, where are you? Can't you see what's happening to me? He not only knows what's happening to me and you, He's already built simultaneously a way out with a key in the door. It suddenly expands the statement of Jesus. A sparrow doesn't fall that God doesn't see it. The hairs of your head are numbered. So, how could you think God doesn't know what's happening to you or me? He not only knows, it's part of the trip and His plan, designed to toughen us by increasing the opportunity to use faith. And there's a way of escape already provided. Equal specificity in this verse. As thy day. Not somebody else's day. This was the day I enter a hospital gate or portal, something very strange for me, this week ago Friday. As thy day. And I went in about 5:30 or 6, end of the day. As thy day, thy strength. God not only knows where you are and what's happening, He measures out enough He doesn't promise tomorrow's strength. Every time I've preached this message, I've pointed out no one ever had a nervous breakdown over today's problems. It's worrying about what's going to hit you tomorrow. Well, sufficient to the day is the evil thereof, and as thy day, thy strength. Measured out exactly. And as I laid on that table, watching my heartbeat, I whispered this verse over and over. My day ain't over. I'm still making it. And when tomorrow comes, He'll measure out the strength to face it. That's the promise every one of us has. We have no promise beyond tomorrow here. We got all our tomorrows, as the song said, in His hands in eternity. But instead of being a worry wart, this day ain't over. As thy day, thy strength, my day's brought me here. My strength has got me still alive. And my day tomorrow will measure it out for me again. I'm in God's hands. As thy day, thy strength. I don't know what you're facing. How many of you even the last week thought you wouldn't make it? Put your hand up. Why are you here? And why did you think you wouldn't make it? Well, this one's going to get me down, and tomorrow will be over. As thy day, thy strength. I've covered this ground so much you're bored with it. Let me go to the next one, which is more important. I'll never get this one across adequately. As thy day, thy strength. The eternal God is thy refuge. Now, the word God's important, but not the most important word of this phrase. It's Elohim, not Jehovah. It's the name of God in the plural that's created everything in the beginnings of Genesis. But in this case, they give Him an additional name. If you want it literal, it's the God of the forefront. But the word eternal has a vast use. This same word has a vast use throughout Scripture. You're going to find it in Genesis 2 when God talks about the garden, the plant of the garden in the east. Uses the same root. When Ezekiel talks of the restored temple in the millennium, Eastern Gate, and the sections of the east. It covers in poetic language in Hebrew everything from the dawn of the morning, which is why the word is used for east, where the day begins. It speaks of being in front, both in place and time. It conveys all the message of ever repeating, like the sunrise coming up every morning. And it doesn't even come close to communicating to us its meaning when you just take the simple word eternal. The God who's always in front, always there, always before us, but always ready to burst forth again in new life, day after day. And I've had to lift you out of time when I've preached this message and try to make your mind focus with me out of our center of the universe view of things and view this word in its root translation as the God of the forefront in a period of processions like dawnings of days and always in front, in place or position. and said, get out of time with me for a moment. Time is relative, you know that, whether you can understand Einstein's theories or not, you know time is relative. We say it, we don't really understand. When God says, I'm Alpha, beginning, and Omega, beginning and end. But let's view time as a parade. Now, our life proceeds like this. What is in front of us, to us, is yet to come. Right? And what has happened to us, like my surgery, is behind. That's history. So we're trailing history and fearing future. What's up front, yet to come, what's happened, already gone by. But in a parade, what's up front, as we're viewing it now, has already gone by. You with me? And what is behind is yet to come. Right? We're outside time now. And all you people are the parade of time. And we're up here with God. What's yet to come that's fearful and uncertain for us already went by in the parade. And what's behind us is yet to come. Thank God we're not legalists, or what's gone by will rise up in the front at the white throne judgment to measure us out. From eternity's standpoint, what's up front yet gone by. Nothing new, it's gone by. Been there, done that. What's behind is yet to come. Now, what this word eternal means is the leader of the parade, the birthing of the morning of every day, the God most powerful who created the universes has made every turn, crossed every pathway, looked at every uncertainty, and is on the corner in front of me before I get there. I didn't expect what happened to me. Didn't surprise God. And the God who enters into all things to work His will. I came to the rest, if not complete, enough to have peace and no worry as the surgery progressed and they wheeled me out into what would become oblivion as I went into sleep and another surgery I didn't know about. The God of the forefront was there to clear the way before I got there. I can tell you this. He had the best in town. Waiting with a wheelchair when I got there. That's pretty good. I mean, I'm not unaware that lots of people have the same and worse. And they don't have the best in town. Waiting with a wheelchair. And the chief administrator of the hospital there to make sure everything moves. The God of the forefront is thy refuge, not a good translation, dwelling place. You've heard this message 21 times, now 22. You've heard Psalm 84, I don't know how many times. Blessed is the man whose strength is in thee. Where are you putting your strength? Again, where is your dwelling place? I've asked myself that question again as I pulled this nitro pill out. Where is my dwelling place? in the heart of my fears, in the uncertainties of my head, in the best-intentioned vestigial remnants of the spirit of Jacob, who knows what's best and wants it, but can't rest in God. Where's my dwelling place? That's why I love that song and had him sing it twice. George Beverly Shea used to fill the airways with us. Now we'll fill the airways with it. I'd rather have Jesus than anything. And he got there first. And I had to question myself. Is he my dwelling place? Ask yourself today. Where's your dwelling place? The things of this world, your career, you're this and you're that, and you're these other things. It's a tough trip, tough shoes. Day by day, strength measured out. The God who gets there first, been there, done that, is my dwelling place. If he's with me, that's enough. If he's my dwelling place, and I leave this table and never wake up, I wake up in him, as you do. There are times in life you need a reality check. Is this all there is? And this 22 years of ministry has been foolish parody. Or are we really learning and are we really communicating to a world who needs to hear it? The God of enough. God revealed himself to Abram, El Shaddai. I preached that on Mother's Day. Dr. Price used to translate the word, and I think as well as any, the enough God. God said to Abram, I'm the enough God. I'm enough. All these other things, take them away, you give them back. The eternal, the God of the forefront, is thy refuge. I think I passed that test, God me know, that night. I think those around me did not see any fear or anxieties on my part. I settled that in that room under the cover of bravado and jokes. There's one more promise. Shoes tough enough. Strength for the day. God of the forefront, thy dwelling place. You really can come out of yourself and things and say, God, my dwelling place, and he's with me. Blessed is the man whose strength is in thee. One more. Underneath of the everlasting arms. Underneath is a root word in Hebrew that means bottom. And underneath bottom. But it also has a whole series of other meanings. I scribbled some of them in my Bible. It means at its root idea, depressing, humbling, beating down. We do that to ourselves, others do it to us, the experience does it. Beaten down. No place to turn, try and find a rock to crawl under. Bottomless. How far down is bottomless? Underneath, one translator says, think to a vanishing point. until, if we can stretch our mind that far, we are past the realm of conscious awareness of how far, vanishing point. So low, so beat down, so depressed, bottomless, and underneath, past the vanishing point. Now that's worse than any of us get in. And it means that if I forget the trip is so tough and start complaining and beating on myself and depressed, and I think the day's about used up its quota. And yeah, it sounds good that God gets there before I get there, and He's my dwelling place, but you better pick better places to sit. I don't want to give up. Ready to quit. Can't take it anymore. Broken. Beat down. Underneath that. Because He knows we're going to stumble and fall. Everlasting arms. I've parodied this before. God with His power, if the fall is that far down, He could be doing something else in the kitchen and see you falling and get over there and get His arms in place. But because He knows we're going to slip, stumble, and fall. You wonder sometimes why I'm a sucker for, sorry, sir. Because this is the God I serve. He knows the heart, I don't. But you can fall and fall and fall, or not fall. He keeps His arms there just in case. Underneath the lowest fall, everlasting arms, which always symbolize strength. He'll pick you up. And I'm saying, a spiritual nitro pill when you need it. If you want to give up because the trip is tough, sorry, that's part of the journey. All I'm saying, God's word of promise is behind, forever settled in heaven. The shoes He's going to give you and gives you are tough enough for the trip. If you're going to quit, don't do it tonight. Go to sleep and wait till tomorrow and see what He measures out to you. Don't quit at night. As thy day, thy strength. If the uncertainty and the unexpected is crushing you, the God of the forefront's already gotten there before you got there. And retreat into Him. The eternal God is thy dwelling place forever. And when you fall and are depressed and beat down, glory be to God and His grace. The arms are there to pick you up. Believe it. Pop it under your spiritual tongue and whisper to God, this is your promise today, as it was mine and His mind today. And that's my message.